Putting the ain't in saint, you're listening to Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show. And now here's your host, Drew Marshall.
A million footsteps, this left foot drags behind my right. I keep walking from daybreak till falling night. Days turn into weeks and years turn into lifetimes. Just keep walking, like I've been walking for a thousand years. Walk away in emptiness, walk away in sorrow. Walk away from yesterday, walk away tomorrow. Walking to escape, or escape from your affliction. You'll be walking in a great circle, in a circle of addiction. And did you ever wonder what you've been carrying since the world was black? See yourself in a looking glass with a tombstone on your back. Walk away in emptiness, walk away in sorrow. Walk away from yesterday, walk away tomorrow. Walk away in itself, walk into the rain. Oh, this wandering has led me to this place. Inside the well of my memory, sweet rain of forgiveness.
I'm just hanging here in space. And dearest hope, as I've been walking, and I'm hanging from a dead man's rope. With hell below me, and heaven in the sky above, I've been walking.
All right, thanks for tuning in, folks. You're listening to the Drew Marshall Show. This is our last show of season 13. Who'd have thunk? Can't believe
what, that we get to 13 or that it must be the last show?
No, that I would have got to 13 seasons. So should have been kicked off the air numerous times. It's time for Drew's Pilgrimage Preparation. See, that's a little nifty thing we came up with there. This October, right after my first grandchild was born, I'll be heading out on the Camino de Santiago. For well over 1,000 years, millions of pilgrims have walked the Way of St. James, the most popular route being almost 800 kilometers, beginning in France, going over the Pyrenees Mountains, across to northern Spain to the Atlantic. And just to make things interesting, I will be doing the entire trail in a vow of silence. I've kind of been in training for that. I think I'm in week 17, posting about that every week on a website called CaminoConfessions.com. You can, if you need a good nap, you can go there and just have a read of some of those things. So the plan is to finish the Camino on my 50th birthday on November 30th. And every Saturday in July, of course, this being the last Saturday, I've been interviewing a variety of Camino gurus in order to prepare for my upcoming bucket list experience. And I wanted to finish with this guy. We've got one more gentleman after him. Robert Ward will be... We'll be speaking to him, sometime between 2:30 and 3. He's the author of All the Good Pilgrims, Tales of the Camino de Santiago. This is a guy who's an agnostic who walked the walk, and since I don't even know what the heck I believe in anymore, I thought it might be good to have Robert on the show. But before Robert, Andrew McCarthy will join us. He's a director, an award-winning travel writer, and of course, an actor. He made his professional debut at 19 in a movie called Class. Did you ever see that?
I don't know if I saw Class, no.
He's appeared in dozens of films, including, what are these movies called? Pretty in Pink, I think is what it's called.
Yeah, some sort of color.
There's one with a puppet from Sesame Street, Elmo's Fire, Less Than Zero. It's Your Dating Life, Tim.
Usually my mark in math.
True. And, of course, Weekend at Bernie's. And,
what a great one.
Mannequin. He has starred on Broadway and on television, most recently appearing in The Family on ABC. McCarthy is also a highly regarded television director, having helmed Orange is the New Black, The Blacklist, Grace and Frankie, and many others. Simultaneously, he's an award-winning travel writer. He is an editor-at-large, National Geographic. This bio goes on. I don't want to read it anymore. So much stuff here. It's so boring. AndrewMcCarthy.com. How are you, sir? Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
What did we catch you in the middle of? Are you in New York? Are you in Jersey? Joysy? Where are you at?
I'm in New York City, yeah, at home in New York City.
Okay, good. Any idea what you're getting yourself into? Are you regretting it at any point?
Yeah. No, so far so good.
Okay.
I have three small kids. I'm ready for anything.
Okay, good. First question, of course, I have for Andrew McCarthy is, what the heck are you doing with all the stolen mannequins? What the heck's going on?
Yeah, what is all that? I keep getting on Twitter, all these people are accusing me of mannequin theft up in Canada, and I just want to be very clear that my passport shows I have not been in Canada recently, so it's not me.
Yeah, I think the Toronto Sun wrote, did you not tweet them, or there's an article I read in the Toronto Sun about
you? They accused me of stealing mannequins in the Toronto Sun, so I had to defend myself.
Yeah.
I thought that was a reputable newspaper.
It's not, well, they do have girls in bathing suits, so reputable, eh.
It's not mannequins in bathing suits.
It's, yeah, they should move to that. Mannequins in bathing suits. That's where we're going in the future. Why is it always the conservative outlets have the hottest girls, like Fox, right? I don't get that. Okay, I want to get something out of the way, and then we'll get into the real stuff that I want to talk about, okay? Because this comes up every stinking interview you do. So let me just quote you and tell me if this is true, because sometimes media doesn't get it right. You ready?
Go.
The backpack didn't exist. It did not exist. We never hung out. Well, they may have hung out. I don't know their phone numbers. I've never talked to a single one of them since we wrapped St. Elmo's fire. It's all just some lazy, blanking journalist lumping it all together.
That's like a young, hostile guy.
So, but you withdrew from that identity, right? Was that because the trajectory that your life was on was not your choice, like this sort of, these kinds of movies and what you were thinking you were going towards, this wasn't really part of it? It just happened to go that way?
Well, I mean, I guess that's one way to look at it. But I mean, I think I think the whole Brad Pack thing has become this sort of affectionate, iconic term now. You know, I think at the time it was sort of a limiting and used as in a pejorative way. And it sort of puts people in a box. Nobody likes to be put in a box, you know? So I suppose it's at a certain phase in life I've railed against it. But now I kind of look back on all that stuff with great affection, I think. And I think people view all that those Brad Pack movies with a great sort of iconic, you know, wistfulness.
Sure.
And I think, you know, they're great.
Sure. Okay. All right. Now, I know you're hanging out a bit with James Spader as you've been directing him in The Blacklist. Any of the other gang? And that's what people want to know in this whole thing. And that's why I said I want to get this out of the way and then get into the real conversation. I mean, you know, are you doing blow and hookers with Charlie Sheen at all? Or, you know, what's...
I've actually never met Charlie, but it sounds like a good time. you know, I was working with James yesterday, and one of the guys on set, this young guy, came up and we saw me and Jimmy laughing, and he said, what were you guys like back in the day? And James just looked at him and said, we were exactly the same. He said, only now we're more so, you know, which is sort of captures, you know, it's all, I guess I tweeted with Molly not long ago and with John Cryer, but you know, when we sort of come across each other, it's one of these strange things. It's like, we're all a member of a very small and strange club, so we sort of should have a secret handshake. And there's a certain knowing that, you know, you come along with this moniker that sort of follows you through life.
But you were known to be a bit of a volatile putz when it came to people coming up to you back in those days and fawning all over you and saying, you know, ooh, I wanted my life to be like your life, and I wanted to be your friends, and your friends are my friends. You know, they were just getting goofy with you. Did you ever want to pound somebody?
I more wanted to withdraw than pound them. I just wanted to sort of disappear from it.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a little... ill-equipped and unprepared for celebrity when it found me so young.
Yeah.
You know, and mostly I just retreated from it, I think.
Okay, well, let's summarize this next part. You just got cut from high school basketball team. You're moping around the house. Your mom said, why don't you try out for the school play, Oliver? And then next thing you know, you're in NYU for acting. After 2 years, you got kicked out because really the only classes you went to were the acting classes. Then you got a job as an actor. And then because you were an 18-year-old, vulnerable, sensitive guy, you got your first movie class. And then after the movie, NYU asked you to come back. And then you were a Pepsi boy in a Burger King commercial. Then you were suddenly a 22-year-old Brad Pack star. Did I get that right?
This is my whole life. I'm like 12 seconds there, yeah.
That's your epitaph.
No, I think the epitaph is Andrew Pretty and Pink McCarthy. Anyway, yeah, I mean, my start when I was very young just sort of happened to me. It was one of those things that just sort of, in hindsight, just sort of happened and seemed to have a destiny of its own over which I had very little control.
Who said, "You're wading in the water and it will drown you. Just jump in the deep end"?
That was my first acting teacher. You've done your research. That was my first acting teacher, actually. And then, you know, my only teacher that had any effect on my life. I think, you know, if you have one good teacher in life, it's what you need. And I had one who saw me and kind of said, you know, I see you and you have something to offer. And but she's, I think she was just referring to my my style of acting, just sort of withholding and not following impulses and things. And yeah. She just said, leap, you know.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
I suppose could be applied to life in all its facets, but she was referring to acting.
Sure. Yeah, Canadians aren't known for being great leapers. We're toe dippers, right? Wouldn't you say, Tim? Politically, you know, religiously.
Toe dippers?
Culturally, we're toe dippers.
Yeah, well, because the water's always so cold, right?
Yeah, you don't want to be jumping.
Yeah, the water, it's much colder up there. Yeah.
Hey, did Jacqueline Bisset ever come over for dinner, or was your dad always bugged that you turned out to be a thespian?
Well, yeah, my dad was not in favor of me being an actor at all until I got a job opposite Jacqueline Bisset, and then he invited me. He said, bring her home to dinner, which Jackie politely declined.
Well, that's nice. I guess he would have been happier if you were like a money man like he was, right? Did he want you to get into the money game?
I'm not sure what he wanted. I just didn't come from an acting brood, you know. So the idea of anyone sort of becoming an actor, that we didn't know anyone was an actor, and it seemed very sort of fraught with unemployment and strange sexual choices in his mind. So I think it just frightened my parents.
No question. Are you, by the way, I want to let our listeners know we're on the phone with Andrew McCarthy. He's an actor. He's a travel guy. He's so much more than great hair. By the way, your hair freaking rocks. It's ridiculous. We are also streaming our live video on our Facebook page. If you go to the Drew Marshall Show Facebook page, you will see Tim the Tool, myself, and Tucker the Wonder Dog sitting by my feet. Are you, Andrew, are you a restrained, wary, circumspect, wry, and authentic observer because you were the youngest of three boys? Well, until you were nine and then another brother came along. But being the youngest of the brothers, all that stuff, I mean, how did... You're kind of a shapeshifter.
God, I don't know how to answer any of that. I suppose I'm all those things and none of those things, but I always was a watcher, that's for sure. And my brothers were more the star of the family than I was growing up, so I just sort of sat back and observed.
So I should be interviewing one of your brothers because they're more of a star than you? Come on.
Yeah. No, but I mean, you know the way families are. They have their own dynamic. And then and then you grow up and the real world intervenes, but still when you go back into your family dynamic, it's exactly as it was when you were a kid. Yeah. You know what I mean? Everybody yeah. reverts back and takes the same roles that they've always had, which is why people's family drives them crazy. Because it's like, I'm a different person now, and yet in my family, I'm still not.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get it. I mean, I'm the same. When I get together with my family, I shut up. I just don't talk, really. I just sit in the corner and rock, you know, with my thumb in my mouth. Just talk to me about this novel, Just Fly Away. Is that coming out soon?
It comes out in March 2017, next year, next March.
And is this a young adult's thing, or what's going on? Like, because there's some youthfulness to this, right?
It's a young adult novel. It's about a 15-year-old girl who finds out she has an 8-year-old brother living across town from a brief affair her father had. And so she just sort of rocks her world. She loses faith in her father. She realizes she has this brother. And that people are not always entirely what they seem to be. So, yeah, I mean, it all came about by accident. I was working on a grown-up novel and for years, and I seemed to be the only one that thought it was any good. And then my favorite character in it was this 15-year-old girl, and one day I just started writing from her perspective, and the whole thing changed, and suddenly I was writing a young adult novel. But it was a real testament, actually, to the idea that sort of nothing is lost, you know? You just keep sort of plugging away, and things sort of have a way of finding their voice. So, yeah, I'm excited by that. I hadn't written a novel before, so it was interesting to follow her along, and who knew my muse was a 15-year-old girl?
Yeah, who knew? Who changed your life? I mean, other than Paul Thoreau, after you read the old Patagonian Express, who else?
Well, I think his book, changed my life because I started traveling once I read that book, and it really inspired me to hit the road, and that and travel changed my life. I had the acting teacher you quoted earlier, she changed my life because she was the first person who I felt like saw me.
Yeah.
You know, we just need someone to see us, and so she saw me, and that was all I needed. So I'd say those two people had a large effect on my life.
Andrew, I know you have coin. Because you're kind of a big deal. People know you. I know you got cash. I know you got cash. But isn't therapy cheaper than traveling?
Actually not. You can travel very, very cheaply. I proved to my friends that you can actually travel for cheaper than the cost to stay home.
Well, no, but I mean, look, I know you're famous for this saying, and other people as well, and I've shortened it a little bit to make it sound a little more like your own hood where you grew up. Where you go, there you are. So you don't use travel as an escape, right? I mean, that's what the booze was for.
Yeah, I suppose I mean, you're referring to one. I used to drink a lot when I was young. Booze was an escape, certainly it always is, but then, you know, there's nowhere to run with it. There's that great phrase, man takes a drink takes a drink, then the drink takes the man. So it always turns back in on you. But but I think travel can also be an escape, too. But again, then eventually it turns around to, you know, you can run, but you can't hide. There you are. I use travel more as a university in my life, I suppose, than as an escape.
Yeah, okay, so here's a quote from you. I'm a better version of myself when I'm far away. I resonate so much with that, and that's when I started reading this stuff on you. I thought, man, this guy, I've got to get this guy on the show, because it I think it's weird that for me, because the thing I value the most is connection, right? It's for me, everything is about connection, and yet I seem to find more connection with people when I'm traveling. That's weird, isn't it?
Well, I mean, people tell me it's weird, but I have the exact same experience. And I think it's one of the degree to which a person is comfortable with paradox, I think, is the degree to which they are comfortable with themselves. I mean, that is a great paradox. The further away from home I get, the closer to home in myself I feel. And, you know, maybe perhaps because I'm jettisoned from all my bound the things that keep me locked in at home, I'm free to be who I want to be on the road. I don't know, but I do certainly find... For me, travel was all initially, and what the Camino, you know, I know you're going to walk the Camino, what the Camino was about was discovering and walking through fear, you know, and I think fear limits everybody to such a massive degree that without even knowing it, and travel to me is just sort of a conscious act of walking through fear. And whenever we walk through fear and get on the other side, we feel like ourselves and we feel buoyant and expansive and like the world's a friendly place.
Okay, so just, I guess, kind of teefing off that, Mark Twain, you know, his famous saying about travel. Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow mindfulness. Apparently, Donald Trump hasn't traveled much.
Ah! Donald doesn't stray far from the Trump Tower. Well, I mean, I think that's totally true. My soapbox, my great soapbox is that, you know, America's a great country. I'm proud to be American and live in America up to this point till the election. And but I think America's really fearful, and I think we make a lot of decisions based on fear. Look at the Trump candidacy. It's all based on fear. And I think the minute you go traveling outside your comfort zone and put yourself at the mercy of strangers and say, can you help me? The world receives us in a really powerful way. And you'd come back from wherever you go and you're like, hey, that guy with the turban on isn't trying to kill me. He actually was really helpful. And I took my son to Morocco, to the Sahara Desert. Are you crazy? Going to, you know, he's 8 years old and you're taking him to some Muslim country in the desert. And, you know, we liked Disney World. It was really nice. Morocco was incredible. You know, and I just find you come, you know, we're sold a lot of bill of goods down here about what the world is like and how everybody hates is trying to kill us. And it's just, I'm sorry, it's not the case.
Yeah, yeah. On the phone with Andrew McCarthy, Andrew, I every time I go somewhere, so a little while ago, I was in Israel for a month filming a television show, and it was quite fascinating. And of course, I went over to the UK, and I went to Stonehenge, and I went to Glastonbury and drank copious amounts of cask ale with two of the world's leading witches. And then I went up to a Druid retreat center, and then I went over to Iona, which is another pilgrimage for many people, and across Scotland and to the north end of England to Holy Island.
What are you looking for?
What's that?
What are you looking for?
Yeah, I don't know, but all I know is that when I'm out there, I'm always thinking again about connection and story. Like, for me, everything is story. Everything. Is that a disease?
I think it's a nice way to make order of the world. I mean, when I started travel writing, it really helped me see the world. You know, through acting, of course, you're always telling story, but it's not your story. You're interpreting someone else's. I didn't really understand my relation to story until I started writing. But it certainly gives you a sense, tries to make order out of the world when you look at the world through story, and that makes us more comfortable and feel safer.
Okay, so let me throw that back at you. You've done ridiculous amount of traveling, far more than most human beings on this planet. What are you looking for? Is it just a way to make a buck, find story, and spin it into something that feeds the kids?
Well, if you want to find something to feed the kids, it ain't travel writing. You can make hundreds of dollars being a travel writer.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I started writing about it for the same reason I started acting, was because I felt like myself when I did it. You know, the first time I stepped on stage, when I was the Artful Dodger and Oliver that you mentioned too before, I felt suddenly like, oh, there I am. That's me. I feel like me. And so that's the feeling I'm constantly craving, you know, and because then I'm nicer to you, I'm nicer to me, I'm more generous, I'm more expansive, I'm all those things we, you know, all want to be. So, and traveling, I don't know, I just think it's a viable use of time and a good use of time. I think it's not, you know, something reserved for the idle or the wealthy. And
you know, I correlate, this is good, just bear with me in this, because I haven't thunk this one all the way through. But actors and, let's say, I don't know, missionaries or children of any other parent who has a vocation where they travel a lot, right? Army brats, whatever else. I think there's something in that. There's a common denominator there, and the correlation is you learn to develop relationships quickly, and you learn to turn on the skills that people like you fairly quickly. But to maintain a longevity of a durable relationship is maybe missing a little bit. And so it feels more comfortable when I'm out there with new people I don't have to then live with for the rest of my stinking life.
Well, I mean, that may be true. I mean, I'm not particularly any of those things. I don't turn it on and facile and so, you know, I'm very, I spent my whole life being afraid of people.
Okay, that's the end of that theory.
But I mean, for some people, certainly it works. I just think, that's not why I did it, you know? And I mean, I would travel. One of the things that travel writing did for me in my travels, it got me out there. I used to be able to, when I would travel, go, and I would spend days not hearing the sound of my own voice, interacting with anyone else. I would just be in my own head in this new place and having my experiences. And of course, when you start travel writing, you need quotes from people. So it got me out of my shell and talking to people in a different way.
Right.
But, and looking for story, like you're talking about. But when I was just sort of wandering the world, it was much more of an internal thing that was happening, and I suppose it's just different energy and different kind of things that you expose yourself to, but I can be very solitary in the world when I'm traveling, and I prefer, actually,
you know? I think you are an extroverted introvert. At the core, what recharges you is time by yourself. What depletes you is time with others. Not depletes you, but you get recharged more.
It absolutely does. My wife is a, you know, inveterate extrovert, and she's loves to go to a party, comes home jazzed and wants to chat all night long, and after 20 minutes I'm like, I'm exhausted. I'll see you at home, sweetheart. We'll Uber you a car later. So it's a problem.
That's funny. I'm so much more like that. I mean, Tim the Tool, my engineer, and I, we sort of grew up together at this camp, and you know, we were both the extroverts. We were the village idiots, no question. But these days, I just get so we're both the same. Do we get recharged by being by ourselves and shutting down? Right.
Yes. Okay. Especially when I'm a teacher, I'm in, you know, talking, chatting all the time, and then I just go home and.
Yeah, you're sharing too much. This is my interview.
I don't have hair.
It'll be very interesting when you go on the Camino and don't speak
Yeah, okay, Tim, I haven't told you this. The best advice, the best quote I've gotten from anybody about my upcoming Camino excursion in A Vow of Silence is from Andrew McCarthy.
Okay.
He sends me an email and says, dude, you're doing this in silence? Are you kidding me? You have to be able to swear out loud at the Camino.
Nice.
Love it. Apparently,
That's very true. There are moments in the Camino when you're like, what am I doing?
Yeah. Okay, so apparently walking the Camino changed your life. And, of course, you creeping on Jack Hitt changed his life and his phone number. but
you wrote a wonderful book. Have you read it? Did you read that book?
No. I haven't been able to hunker down into any preparation, really, until I wrap up this season, and then I can get into it. So you're saying I got to get this book.
Well, it's why I went, you know, the book called Off the Road, and I thought it was, you know, it inspired. I mean, I read it, and then, and I read it by accident. I literally picked it up by accident in a bookstore, and I read it, and by the time I was finished, 2 weeks later, I was in Spain. I mean, so I'm glad you're doing all this preparation, all that, but I mean, I did not. I bought a pair of hiking boots on the way to the airport. That was my preparation.
Wow. Okay, so on the Camino, you were terrified and lonely and miserable. That kind of sounds like me when I used to go to church. You've said that that people don't really change because of aha moments. I think you've said that. But you had one of these aha moments on the Camino, and it changed you. What the heck was this experience? And are you not telling people about this experience on purpose because you want them to buy your book or because it's personal? Experience?
I do think people change by an aha moment, for sure. But on the Camino, I was walking, and I'd been walking about 2 weeks, maybe more, and I was all those things, lonely, miserable, blisters, you know, having a terrible time, wondering what I was doing. The only reason I didn't go home is because I had bragged to everyone that I was going to walk across Spain, and I couldn't show up, you know, a week later and say, well, I just kind of wimped out. So I was stuck walking, and I was walking. In the middle of the walk, you'll encounter this behind the seta where all these days and days of wheat fields. And it's hot, and there's nothing but wheat, and you just walk. And at the end of a day's walk, there's another village where you sleep. And then the next day, you walk through more wheat, and then there's a village, and you sleep. And it goes on for several days, and it's torturous in a certain way, and very meditative for those enlightened people, but I found it torturous. And I just broke down and was sobbing in the middle of a field of wheat, and I started screaming up at God, you know, all those things that my good Catholic upbringing has promised me I'll go straight to hell for saying, and had a full-blown temper tantrum right there in the middle of the field of wheat. And eventually my tears subsided, and my limousine didn't come pick me up, and I had to keep walking. And the next day, I was sitting by this. I was started out walking again, and I was miserable again. And I sat down by the side of a barn to have my little morning break with my little cheese and my water. And suddenly I could, just everything looked very clear, very crisp visually. Things just seemed very bright. I could almost hear birds call and respond. And I just seemed very awake in a way that I had done nothing to sort of consciously summon. And
maybe the cheese was off, huh?
Maybe the cheese was off. But anyway, I had this sort of realization that seemed more visual than anything. It's like I saw it coming across the horizon. That basically, and I felt like I'd forgotten something. All morning I'm walking, and I feel like I've forgotten something. Do I have my pack? Do I have my map? Do I have everything? And I realized while I was sitting there by the side of the barn, what I didn't have that morning, what I always had, what I was unaware that I ever possessed until the moment of its first absence, was fear. You know, I realized in that moment I was unafraid in a way that I'd never been in my life. And I couldn't explain why, and it was a total sort of aha moment. But all I knew was that I felt like myself, you know, there's an Irish saying, I felt like myself from the toes up. And that's what I felt like myself from the toes up for the first time in my life, except when I first acted, when I was 15 years old playing the Artful Dodger, when I walked out there on the stage, I felt like myself from the toes up. And it was the second time I'd ever felt like that in my life, and I was completely absent of fear. In a way that I'd never, like I said, fear is so ever present in my life, I was unaware of its existence until the moment of its absence.
Right.
You know, and the space that was created by that lack of fear made me want to keep traveling because I wanted that feeling over. I go, there I am. I feel like myself. I want more of that. And so that's why I became a world traveler, and to walk through that fear. And whenever I walk through fear like that, I feel like myself, and I'm a different person. You know, and so I skipped across the rest of Spain. I mean, suddenly a trudge that had been miserable for 2 weeks was now suddenly this joyous march. I met wonderful people. I was suddenly interested in all this crazy religious history that I had no interest in before. And I was a different person, and it was just that moment of realization of how fear had been so dominating in my life that, you know, it was a real life-changing for me.
Okay, so...
But I look back on the Camino with great affection. It was something that... There was a moment before that moment by the side of the barn with that cheese, and the moment after.
But it's, I mean, it's been, what, almost 25 years since you walked the Camino? And have you had that same from-the-toes-up feeling thing?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a bit like lighting a candle in a room that has no candle. Suddenly there's light, and then you light a second one. It's adding just as much light, but it doesn't feel like as much because there's already a little light there.
Right.
You know what I mean? I've experienced it before. And so, yeah, over and over again. But I think for someone like me, fear is sort of an active opponent. You know, you don't just sort of master it once and it's done.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of creeps back in all sorts of forms. And so it's a constant stepping through and struggling against it. So, yeah, I've had it many, many times. And the easiest way for me to have it is through travel. Whereas I get afraid, I'm traveling, but I need to find a bed, so I have to go up to you and ask you, excuse me, do you speak English? Can you help me find somewhere to sleep?
Yeah.
You know, and stepping through that fear every time. And I never would have been able to do any of that had I not had that moment in Spain. So, you know, so, but yes, it's, I've had it over and over, and yet it's something that I have to keep, you know, it's like sand blowing in the door, and you got to keep sweeping it out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Any chance one of your three kids would want to do the Camino with you? Again?
My son wanted to. He's 15 this summer. He wanted to this year, and I said we should, you know, maybe we'll do it next year. He seemed a little, we weren't quite up for it. But he says he wants to, you know, if he still wants to. I hope he does. I mean, it'd be great. If we...
Yeah, that'd be cool. That would be
yeah,
because
yeah,
that's it. Like, as much as I loved, I would way rather travel by myself, and I do it quite often because of the interactions I have with people when I'm by myself, because I'm more dependent on people, and they see me as something. You know, you can just get insular when you're traveling with someone else, and yet the thing I miss the most when I'm traveling by myself is being able to share that scenery, that shot, that interaction, that scenario with someone in my family. Right. So it's a,
well, that's the terrible thing about, you know, loving people is, you know,
right.
And that's the whole thing is, you, how do we hold on to ourselves and yet have these intimate relationships? And how do we balance those
things?
And the answer is, you know, it's impossible, and yet we do it anyway.
Okay, so I turned 50 on November 30th. You turned 54 the day before. And as my senior elder by so many years, what insight do you have for me about the Camino and even turning 50? I mean, I'm trying to recalibrate my spiritual compass in some way. And you know, my intuition, my trust, my ability to find light is way off these days. Probably because I'm not married to someone like Dolores. So what do you give me, man? What do you got?
I got nothing for you, baby.
Oh, come on.
But I mean, what's beautiful about the Camino is it's literally one step at a time, and it just wears you down. And so it just wears down all that sort of resistance, and you slow down. I would certainly recommend leaving your cell phone at home.
Yeah, that's a mood point for sure.
You know, it's...
And wouldn't help me having a cell phone, well, maybe texting, I guess, but I'm not talking, right?
Yeah, but so. We can avoid ourselves constantly with that stuff. We can avoid sitting through any uncomfortability with that stuff.
Right.
And, you know, we do it all the time. I wouldn't, you know, the one thing I've learned is never to offer any advice. And what do I know? But but the sheer walking wears one down on that stuff. And, you know, I think that's, when I finally give up on the big aha moments, like we were talking about before, is when we finally have them, of course, right?
Yeah.
And my any spirituality I've had since then has been much more of a sort of brick and mortar kind, as opposed to more aha kind of thing. And to me, that kind of very methodical kind of sweeping out the sand every day is much more less exciting, but probably more.
Oh, sure. I mean, one of the reasons I've struggled with the spiritual stuff, even though this is what I do, you know, I'm a former pastor who now looks at himself in the mirror and sort of laughs and thinks, who are you kidding, being one of those guys, is the fact that I have a really hard time finding the God of the in-betweens. The God of the highs and the God of the lows, no worries. Get that. Everybody gets that. We reach out when it's crazy high or crazy low. But the God of sweeping sand, like you talked about, man, that sucks. I, you know, it's the mundane spiritual disciplines. I don't know. I can't even spell discipline, so maybe that's why I suck spiritually. But you grew up in you can't have the name Andrew McCarthy and not have some, you know, Catholic stuff happening.
Yeah, I grew up, I'm a recovering Catholic. I grew up going to Mass every Sunday and catechism and, you know, confirmation and all that. Yeah.
So what have you done with the God stuff, with the Jesus stuff? Forget the church stuff. That's a whole other thing. Forget religion. We get that. Church, religion, it's tainted. Humanity got in there and screwed it up. But what about, is there something else? Is there a God? Is there supernatural?
Well, my experience in life seems to be when I actually, that something happens. And there's some kind of energy that happens.
Yeah.
And I've always kind of, my cop-out is that if I could begin to understand it, then that can't be it.
Exactly.
Because if it's so greater than it, how can I begin to, as any kind of box I put it in, that's just for my own comfort. But beyond that, isn't that what faith is? I mean, I suppose, I don't know. But I'm comfortable enough with knowing that if I could understand it, it can't be it.
Yeah, there should be a certain unfigure outability about God. If you're starting to figure out God, then you got the wrong God.
And so, of course, we all want things to hold on to, and we can't really hold on to that very well.
No.
It's sort of like, you know, stepping out from point A to, and then where is it? We want point B, but if we just step out, I think the act of stepping out is faith, and, you know, we're all, my experience is there's always been a land when I stepped out. But yes, having active faith, you know, and I think having ambivalence is a great thing. You know, I have ambivalence about pretty much everything, and it's a very uncomfortable place to be often, because certainty certainly feels better. But I think if I can get comfortable in my ambivalence, when I'm there, I'm in a great place.
Yeah.
And I'm very, and then I'm suddenly kinder and more magnanimous, and I'm more compassionate, and I'm more understanding, and isn't that more godlike? You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Isn't that what Jesus told everyone to be?
Yeah.
Well, I guess.
That's what I've heard.
I don't know. When I can be comfortable there, which is not often, but when I can, in that ambivalence, in the unknowing, then I'm in a great spot.
Well, his travel memoir, The Longest Way Home, became a New York Times bestseller, and the Financial Times of London named it one of the best books of the year. And of course, we're going to be looking forward to his debut novel, Just Fly Away, be published, when did you say? Spring of 17?
Yeah, next March, yeah.
Okay, all right. AndrewMcCarthy.com, that's the website. The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. Very much resonate with so much of what you've said. A tagline for our show is that doubt is more compatible with faith than certainty. And so,
oh, that's good.
I think ambivalence is a spiritual gift.
Doesn't feel that way, though, does it?
it's frustrating because we live in this. Well, of course, North American, religious spiritual stuff or whatever. Everything's supposed to be grab-onable. There should be an end to every story.
Because it's frightening not to be able to hold on to something. It's just frightening.
Yeah.
So it's just falling.
Well, I'm sorry we went so long, but I'm not. Man, that was enjoyable. What a great last Camino guru interview, Andrew. I really appreciate your time and how you do things. I wish you the best. I really do, actually. I know that sounds like a suck-up thing you're supposed to say on the radio, but I do.
Thank you, and good luck on your walk. Let me know how it goes. I'd like to talk to you afterward.
Well, yeah, if I get talking to you, I think I might like this no-talking thing so much that I might have to find a new line of work.
Dude, you're a better man than me doing that without talking.
I know. I don't know what I've got myself into, but something. I know the ingredients. I don't know what. I have no expectations. I really don't, other than blisters. But I know that I've got the right ingredients for something to happen, for something to penetrate my soul. My soul's getting.
Have you ever not spoken for an extended period of time?
The last 17 weeks, I've done a day a week. That's it.
How's that? Hard?
The first little bit was I was just hyper focusing on not talking, so I was getting jack out of it, right? Nothing, because I was just don't talk. What's that scene out of The Simpsons? Tim, how did it go?
Don't see revenge. Don't see revenge. Don't see revenge.
Don't revenge. And then afterwards, I started noticing things that I just maybe really didn't pay attention to before. And again, it's story. Hold on. Jeez, we got to finish talking here. One of the reasons I just put this together now. What an idiot. One of the reasons that I decided to do the Camino Silent was because of Orange is the New Black. The character on there that doesn't talk.
Oh, yeah.
There was an episode or two where they started, all the girls started surrounding her and unloading their lives on her and confessing stuff to her. And I started thinking, that's the thing I love the most, is being there for people. And people say, what do you miss about being a pastor? Well, I miss being paid to be available for people. I miss, you know, I'm still a hospital chaplain, and I love asking and listening. I love asking and listening. And so I want to see if I can still, if people will still talk to me, even though I'm not using my verbal skills to crack them open. I want to know if silence cracks people open.
Oh, it's interesting because you see the same people if you're on over and over and over on along the Camino. So you sort of, even if you don't talk to them, you sort of go, oh, there's the Dutch guy and there's the German lady. And you sort of have a nodding, you have relationships with all these people that you don't even speak to.
Yeah.
Even if you are talking, you know what I mean? I would see people over the course and I'd say, oh, they look tired today. Or, oh, they look good. You know what I mean? And so you have these sort of imaginary or one-sided relationships. Well, not one-sided, but nonverbal relationships with people who you see who are going through the same experience. So it'll be very interesting to see if people then do open up to you as a, you know, as a receptacle for their stress and misery along the way.
Basically, I'm like a walking bottle of Johnny Walker, right? That's it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man. Anyway, Andrew, thanks, man. I appreciate it again, and we will be in touch.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye. Andrew McCarthy on the Drew Marshall Show. Ah, that was good. It's nice to have a good conversation every once in a while. AndrewMcCarthy.com. That's the website. You might remember him from such films as St. Elmo's Fire, Pretty in Pink, Weekend at Bernie's, etc., etc. I would recommend getting his book, The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. It's been out for a few years, but it's still a good read. All right, a short break, and when we come back, Robert Ward. He's the author of All the Good Pilgrims, Tales of the Camino de Santiago. He'll be our last Camino guru. Is that what we're calling them? Yeah, Camino gurus. He's an agnostic who went on this religious pilgrimage thing. So I think that's interesting. That's why he's on the show. Stay with us.